Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott.
Go ahead, I'll follow you.
Okay.
I'm walking down into a basement in New Jersey with a broad-shouldered guy named Tom Duff. The basement is finished and neat, much neater than my own. It's basically a storage space for clothes, shoes, a few crock pots, lots of wicker baskets. Everything is wrapped in plastic and put away on shelves. The electric meter is ticking in the corner. And Tom shines his flashlight into a shallow crawl space. The homeowner is right next to him, craning his neck, trying to see what's going on. And Tom immediately spots the suspect we came here to chase.
It should be dark wood, but if you look where my light is, right there, it's got kind of a light haze.
Yeah, I see the one next to the left.
Yep, and usually that white haze will test as what's called Aspergillus penicillium.
That's mold. And that's bad news. The spores could be making the people living in the house sick. They'll cost thousands of dollars to remove, and they've likely been growing here for a long time. So if you wanted to buy this home, you would want to know about this, right? This pre-existing condition. Things that were already there, already in place, they shape our present. They can pose major challenges and offer opportunities. And on today's show, we'll investigate pre-existing conditions in all kinds of places. In earthquake zones, along seashores, under trees that smell lovely but are a major fire hazard. But let's start with the topic that we most associate with pre-existing conditions: health insurance.
Having pre-existing conditions.
Pre-existing condition.
Pre-existing condition.
Have a pre-existing condition.
Pre-existing condition.
These two words have been playing a major role in our country's heated debate around healthcare, and there's good reason for that. Before the Affordable Care Act, people with all sorts of different illnesses had massive problems getting health insurance, and addressing that issue was central to President Obama's legislation. And as Republicans shaped their own healthcare act in the last few months, President Trump was quick to reassure Americans that this was an important issue for him, too.
First, we should ensure that Americans with pre-existing conditions have access to coverage and that we have a stable transition for Americans currently enrolled in the health care exchanges.
The GOP's health bill failed to make it to a vote, but in the final hours of congressional debates, pre-existing conditions bubbled up again in questions about what kind of health services insurers must cover. But how did they become such a huge part of America's healthcare crisis? Alana Gordon guides us through the twists and turns.
For starters, this issue is not only complicated, it's been a long time in the making. And to explore why, let's switch gears for just a minute. Go back in time and talk about firehouses.
You would think of the volunteer fire departments of the 19th century.
This is John Bertko. He's not a fireman. He's in insurance. More on that soon. But first,
you couldn't put out a house fire yourself. And so you'd contribute both time and money, and the community would buy a fire engine.
Hopefully, nothing would ever happen to your house. But if it did, the trucks and hoses were on hand to help. Bertko says in the early 20th century, health insurance kind of worked in a similar way. In communities around the country, the main doctor and hospital groups started up Blue Cross and Blue Shield nonprofits. These blues, as they were called,
would take a certain small amount of money per month, and then for that amount of money, they would guarantee that a person could come in and have a doctor treat them, or that they could get into a hospital and their hospital bills would be paid for.
At this point, the notion of pre-existing conditions wasn't really seen as a thing, largely because the blues were regulated by each state as a community benefit.
And that meant that your profits were limited, that your goal would be to provide healthcare services at the lowest possible cost to members of the community.
Around World War II, the health insurance landscape grew, as did healthcare itself. The Blues were still the insurance administrators, but coverage largely became defined by your employer. There were wage controls at the time, so employers and workers negotiated an alternative benefit, healthcare. Keep in mind, these were often big companies with a lot of employees.
And so the risk would be shared across, say, 1,000 or 10,000 or 1 million people.
There's a reason John Bertko knows a lot about this.
I've been an actuary for 40 years.
For Humana, for the feds, and now for the state of California. He's basically the guy that tries to predict who's likely to get sick and what those costs will be in any given year. It's important to note that this is really, really hard to do. But first, back to this history lesson.
The Harry S. Truman Library at Independence, Missouri.
In the mid-60s, Medicaid and Medicare were signed into law by Lyndon Johnson.
Will make the Medicare bill a part of Social Security coverage.
By that time, something else was really gaining traction.
For-profit insurance companies decided to jump in, and they immediately recognized some people were much more likely to use services. They might have some conditions already, or they might be prone to have conditions.
The for-profits realized they could make more money if they only covered healthy people and the people who were most likely to stay healthy.
Yep, that's right. And the name of that science is underwriting.
That tricky practice of trying to identify who's most likely to get sick and need costly care, and then factor that into the price and scope of their health coverage. And this is where we see pre-existing conditions really take hold. To keep up, the Blues got on board.
So the company started out by having a list of about 20 conditions.
I had a stroke.
I have kidney disease.
I had breast cancer.
I have HIV.
And these would be what I would call very, very serious conditions.
I have a rare heart condition.
I have prostate cancer.
I have lupus.
I have diabetes.
I've been in drug and alcohol treatment.
I have sleep apnea.
But as they found out how well this worked, the list got longer.
I'm pregnant.
I'm thinking about getting pregnant.
And longer and more complicated.
I have asthma.
I have allergies.
So that by the time of the 21st century,
sprained my ankle.
I have the list would be as many as 400 different conditions of varying difficulties.
I have high blood pressure.
I have acne.
400?
Yes.
Now, the feds placed protections on people who already had coverage through their work. But some Americans rely on the individual market. Small farmers, the self-employed, and people like Carl Ugin from Littlestown, Pennsylvania. In the early 80s, his situation changed overnight.
The company I worked for called us all to the time clock early one morning and told us that within 48 hours, the entire company would be packed on trucks and moved away to Florida. So with no notice, you know, basically I had no job.
And no guaranteed employer-based health insurance for himself and his family. Carl got a temporary gig as a florist. He loved it, and he started his own business.
And we did custom silk work. You bring me your wallpaper, and I'll make an arrangement to match it.
As for insurance, he went directly to the local Blue Cross Blue Shield and got a small business plan that covered his family. Without being part of that big employer pool, it was a bit of a sticker shock. But business was good, and he managed. But then...
Yeah, about 10 years ago, my house caught fire.
Not literally, but Carl was diagnosed with chronic liver disease, hepatitis B. It was a complete surprise. But then he realized his work years ago as a member of the volunteer fire department might have been the cause.
And this was before the time of breathing masks when you did CPR or gloves. So I was in constant contact with body fluids.
He says the specialty drugs helped manage his condition, but cost thousands of dollars. His insurance covered it. But then he says some unexpected things started happening during the annual policy signups.
Insurance renewals went way up.
And the cost of those renewals kept going up while covering less. Eventually, it became unaffordable. Carl says he had no choice but to drop his family's insurance.
I was devastated because I didn't know when my liver might fail.
According to our insurance guy, John Bertko, Carl's experience was not uncommon.
And many companies, whether they were Blue Cross Blue Shield companies or for-profit companies did similar things over the last 20 years or so before.
Drumroll, please. Act two in our history lesson.
The Affordable Care Act.
Thank you, everybody.
It was March 23rd, 2010, when President Barack Obama signed what's become known as Obamacare into law.
This year, tens of thousands of uninsured Americans with pre-existing conditions.
People like Carl couldn't be denied coverage or faced hefty price increases because they had a health issue. And that coverage had to cover certain things. The idea was this could work for insurers so long as young, healthy people also signed up to spread the risk. This is where the whole individual mandate stems from. Buy insurance or face a fine. Still, Tom Miller believes the ACA placed too much emphasis on pre-existing conditions.
Well, the pre-existing condition issue was used as a marketing device in order to sell a lot of other policies.
Miller is a health insurance expert with the Enterprise Institute, a think tank based in Washington, D.C. He says the issue is that healthcare is just expensive for everyone. And he thinks this emphasis on pre-existing conditions deflected that bigger problem and created other ones. Not enough healthy people enrolled. Some markets, like in Arizona, lost money. The premiums went way up.
When you make insurance much more comprehensive and also try to hide the price of that insurance and the cost of it from as many people as possible, thinking that it'll be somehow be financed below the table, then insurance as a market breaks down. And the question is what type of mangled political mess we're going to try to live with in order to hide more costs.
He believes one answer for pre-existing conditions are these things called high-risk pools. These were around pre-Obamacare as state insurance options for people who couldn't get affordable care because of a pre-existing condition. Karen Politz is with the Kaiser Family Foundation and could not disagree more. She says states who tried these pools faced major challenges. They cost a lot, both for the state and for the patient. And in many states, there was this.
The one that usually surprises people is that these state high-risk pool programs would exclude coverage for the pre-existing condition that made you eligible in the first place.
This wasn't a permanent thing, but it often meant necessary care for a health condition, like those $1,000 health meds, like the ones Carl needed for his hepatitis B. He'd have to wait 6 months to a year before the pool would cover it. Politz acknowledges the ACA has had some growing pains. A lot of healthy people didn't sign up. The current fine of about $700 just wasn't a big enough stick, and coverage for some people was still unaffordable. At the same time, more chronically ill people, like Carl, signed up.
It was transformative. It completely changed the nature of the individual health insurance market. It completely changed the business model of insurance companies that sold in that market.
The uninsured rate is also way down, as is national health spending. And employer-based premiums have risen at a slower rate than they did before the ACA was enacted. Politz was hopeful it would get better. But now we've reached our final act.
Tonight I am also calling on this Congress to repeal and replace Obamacare.
The GOP's recent efforts to replace Obamacare did not gain enough support to make it to an important vote. But proponents have emphasized that pre-existing conditions will be covered in any kind of replacement. Still, one issue that keeps coming up is what will be covered and how that will be paid for. That latest proposal had its own version of the individual mandate incentive, a surcharge on people who don't sign up for continuous coverage. There was a section creating a federal fund for states to use in a number of ways, from providing extra support to insurers who cover more patients with pre-existing conditions to bringing back high-risk pools. It's something House Speaker Paul Ryan was all about at a recent CNN town hall.
State high-risk pools are a smarter way of guaranteeing coverage for people with pre-existing conditions.
Even though the plan has been tabled, the challenges of managing pre-existing conditions don't appear to be going away. So how might this affect Carl? Actually, he just turned 65 and moved into a different neighborhood of coverage, a big one that we all pay into and all join. Medicare.
Medicare is a pretty reliable fire company. We haven't had any troubles with that at all.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
So it looks like pre-existing conditions will remain a pre-existing condition in all of our conversations about healthcare. Too meta. This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about pre-existing conditions today, what came before, what was already there. And let's say I want to buy a house at the beach. That's actually a lifelong dream of mine. And if I ever get to do that, then I probably also want to know that it will be there for a long time, by the end of the century even, and not washed away by storms or rising seas. Of course, this topic goes way beyond one little beach house. It affects entire coastal communities. And reporter Irina Zhurov is here now to talk more about how we can measure what is happening where. Hey, Irina.
Hey, Maiken.
So, Irina, we hear about rising sea levels all of the time as a threat, but it does seem like it's playing out differently in different locations. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so when we talk about sea level rise, we're talking about a global phenomenon, right? The world is warming in large part due to human activity. The higher temperatures warm up the ocean water, which makes it expand and take up more room in the ocean basin. Water is also being added to the ocean when glaciers and ice sheets that used to be frozen solid on land, when they melt and pour into the ocean.
So let's do a little show and tell. I brought with me a bowl with water. That's my ocean. I also have a glass with ice. That's my glacier. And when the glacier melts, it pours into the ocean. And now everything obviously went up in the bowl. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, basically. So you saw that water come up. Think of that as your sea level rise. But the world's ocean basins aren't a bowl that fills up evenly when the glacier melt pours into it. Instead, pre-existing conditions and ongoing processes that are more or less local or regional affect what you actually measure on the ground. And that's because what you're measuring locally is the rate of sea level rise and whatever the land is doing relative to that.
That sounds complicated.
Yeah, so to get a better handle on this, I recently went to Atlantic City, New Jersey, where this is playing out. The city is still quiet, except the sound of construction on the boardwalk in preparation for summer. I went to Steel Pier, a tongue of cement stretching into the Atlantic Ocean, home to bright lights and big rides, once owned by Donald Trump and anointed by the Beatles. In addition to the disassembled amusement rides and construction trailers, the pier is home to something else.
Yep, that's it. Okay. So this is the tide gate.
Ben Horton, a coastal geologist at Rutgers University, joined me on the steel pier. Atlantic City has had a tide gauge for more than 100 years.
The tide gauge is a relatively simple pieces of apparatus. They basically just record the height from a sensor to the water level. It's continuous.
Tide gauges were installed starting in the 1700s, mostly around ports. These long-term records have become very useful for tracking sea levels. The Atlantic City gauge shows that here, sea level appears to be rising around 4 millimeters annually. The global average? 3 millimeters per year. That's about 2 pennies stacked. Go up to Bar Harbor or down to Key West, and it's 2 millimeters annually. It's about 6 in Ocean City, Maryland, about double the global average. It's just 1.5 millimeters in Santa Monica, California, and actually falling in Alaska. Why?
Here along the mid-Atlantic shoreline, there are two processes that are causing the land to sink beneath our feet.
First, groundwater is being pumped up for household use, like drinking and bathing, leaving the land to go down. The other is the Laurentide Ice Sheet, which covered Canada, New England, and parts of the Midwest until about 20,000 years ago. The ice sheet was so thick and heavy, it pushed down the land beneath it and made land on the margins pop up. Imagine someone heavy sitting on an exercise ball.
So if you sit on that, you're compressing it, and then around the margins, you can see it uplift. You get off the exercise ball, it pops up, and an area goes down.
Same thing happens geologically, just more slowly. So around the Hudson Bay, for example, land is popping up, recovering from the weight of the ice sheet. South of the ice sheet, it's sinking back down.
But Irina, it sounds like some of these processes you just mentioned, like with the Laurentide ice sheet, that's been happening for thousands of years. So where does man-made global warming come into this equation?
Yeah, so it can drive the start of those same processes in new places or change how other systems function. So, for example, some scientists say climate change could potentially alter wind patterns or the flow of major currents, which both have the power to push or pull water to or from certain coasts. And then there's gravity. So things that have a very large mass have gravitational pull. So take Greenland. It's got a huge ice sheet, a lot of mass, and it pulls water towards it. When the ice sheet melts, which is happening, that gravitational pull will weaken. So here's Ben Horton again.
And so instead of water being pulled towards it, it won't be pulled as much and will start to wash back into the ocean basins.
With the heavy ice sheet gone, the land will also decompress. It'll rise up.
So when the Greenland ice sheet melts, the land pops up, the water moves away from it, sea level falls around Greenland, which is really counterintuitive.
So, Mike, in that beach house you're dreaming about, maybe don't build it on the Jersey Shore. How about Greenland?
That does sound fantastic. However, if I do want a more traditional beach location, maybe somewhere a little bit warmer, are there models that could advise my choice that could tell me, like, okay, this is a solid plan?
Sort of, but the climate models we have aren't perfect yet. I talked to Ronald Stauffer. He's a retired scientist who spent his career building climate models. And he told me that it's kind of a lot to ask of a model to know everything at a local scale. So Stauffer says models just aren't sensitive enough yet.
They all say it's going to go up, but the details of how much and exactly where don't agree very much from model to model on small scales.
Models do consistently show that local sea levels predicted to go down around Antarctica, and it's predicted to go up along the east coast of North America. But there are still contradictions between models in other places. The biggest agreement, though, is sea levels going up, up, up globally.
Thank you, Irina.
Thanks, Mikan.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about things from the past that are shaping our present. Now, let's head to the wooded hills of Oakland, California. Some residents there want to thin out an invasive tree to make the landscape a little bit more like it used to be. But the question is, when we say used to be, how far should we go back? In this case, we're talking about eucalyptus trees. They were an import from Australia that arrived here in the mid-1800s. They now dominate the area. But some Oakland neighbors feel that after 150 years in the region, they deserve some of the reverence typically given to native species. Andrew Stelzer takes us for a walk.
I'm walking up a muddy trail, and the air smells faintly minty, kind of like Vicks Vapor Rub. The eucalyptus trees have long, narrow, shiny leaves. They can grow more than 100 feet high and create a beautiful shade canopy. But picturesque or not, John Kaufman wants them gone.
They're a dirty tree in that sense, in that they produce a lot of bark that falls off the tree and hangs down from the tree. And that creates a fire ladder. So when a fire starts on the ground for whatever reason, the fire can spread up to the top of the trees.
All trees, brush, and vegetation are flammable. But Kaufman says blue gum eucalyptus groves are especially fire prone. He's vice president of the Claremont Canyon Conservancy. That's a group of neighbors who try to keep homes safe by advocating for fire prevention policies. Back in the hot, dry October of 1991, these hills were the scene of the most devastating urban fire in California's history.
For homeowners, it was a living hell. The fire engulfed canyons and ridges.
25 people died, and more than 3,000 homes were destroyed in the Oakland Hills firestorm. John Kaufman says eucalyptus trees helped aid the fire's rapid spread.
My wife and I evacuated, and fortunately our house didn't burn, but the houses just above us on the hillside were almost totally consumed.
Dead bark and the combustible oil in eucalyptus leaves make good tinder. But ironically, the trees themselves are pretty resistant to fire, and extreme heat actually helps the trees spread their seeds. In addition to the fire danger, the invasive eucalyptus dominate the local ecosystem here. The treetops block out the sun, and eucalyptus roots suck up lots of the water that competing native plants and trees need. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, agreed it would be wise to remove the eucalyptus. In 2015, the agency earmarked money to cull the forest.
You know, if there were ever a species that needed a public relations firm, it's the eucalyptus.
That's Dan Grissetti. He's part of a smaller group of Hills residents that broke off to form their own pro-eucalyptus organization called the Hills Conservation Network.
This is beautiful. This is amazing habitat. You get rid of essentially all the tall trees here, it would be a totally different environment.
Most scientists believe eucalyptus increase the fire danger, but Grissetti and his group point out that the plants that grew here before eucalyptus arrived often caught fire as well.
And so the assertion that somehow the only species that is at play here is eucalyptus, not the houses, not any of the other trees, it's just specious logic.
After some legal wrangling, government experts still say eucalyptus are a fire risk, but the new strategy is to remove far fewer trees than originally planned. The pro-eucalyptus faction won, although opponents say fire science got lost in the fight. They say non-native eucalyptus just don't belong in California at all. For Dow Orion, it's not that simple.
Invasive species are often characterized as these kind of malevolent actors, and they're not. They're just plants or animals, and they have certain characteristics that fit the characteristics of the ecosystems where they're found.
Orion is the author of Beyond the War on Invasive Species. She works as a land management consultant and says we shouldn't automatically blame the plant. If a non-native species is thriving, it shows that something in the environment is changing. Orion's backyard in Oregon has blackberries, a delicious but invasive plant. Rather than spraying pesticides on them, she uses nature to control nature. She sicked her pigs on the berries.
The pigs just went crazy. They love the roots. They dug them all out. They ended up making it into an environment that Himalayan blackberries don't thrive as much.
Orion used to live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I asked her about the Oakland Hills debate over the non-native, fire-prone eucalyptus. Fire management experts might argue she's too lenient on the invaders.
However, there's so much more to the story when we think about what's happening to ecosystems in terms of massive urban and suburban development, draining of wetlands, deforestation, the spread of monoculture agriculture. All of these different things have led to the types of conditions that many invasive species favor.
Humans brought eucalyptus to California, and we've done lots of other things to the landscape since then that should be considered when we worry about the next big fire. Bottom line, the edge of a flammable forest may just not be a very safe place for people to build houses. But Oakland's real estate market is red hot, so whether the eucalyptus go or not, the people and their homes aren't leaving anytime soon. For The Pulse, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
The Pulse is about pre-existing conditions today. We humans have to live somewhere, and no matter where we build our dwellings, we'll encounter some issues to deal with, whether it's eucalyptus trees or rising sea levels. But there's one huge pre-existing condition that people often don't think about, the risk of earthquakes.
That's right, pre-existing by virtue of Mother Nature.
That's Ross Stein. He is a geophysicist, and he runs a company called Tembler. They help people prepare for earthquakes. And he says that even in very earthquake-prone areas, people often don't build with earthquakes in mind. If you think about it, most buildings are essentially stacks of cubes, one room on top of another, on top of the next.
A cube is extremely vulnerable to being shaken from side to side. And the taller you make that stack, the stronger the shaking gets amplified, and the harder it is to build a structure that resists destruction on shaking. So we are almost pathologically choosing a way to live which is maladapted to earthquakes.
Stein says there is a better, more stable way to build.
You could go to any boat in the bay, any sailboat in the bay, and that boat could handle any shaking that was hurled at it by the San Andreas Fault. Boats are built with curves and triangles. They use light materials, fiberglass and wood. They're heavier at the bottom and light on top.
Of course, you can't stack boats or dome shapes, which are also better in earthquakes. And space is usually a commodity, which is why we end up going for the cube model, especially in cities.
And is there any way to retrofit the buildings that are already there? What would that take?
Retrofitting or seismically strengthening buildings is hugely important and can be done. In some kind of buildings, like wood buildings, it's relatively inexpensive, maybe cost 10% of the cost of the new building.
Retrofitting is also possible for modern concrete buildings.
If you walk around, for example, downtown San Francisco, you'll see lots and lots of diagonal steel I-beams, which have been put into place to strengthen the bottom floor of the buildings. So there's an enormous amount that can be done.
What do you think has to happen for people to pay more attention to the earthquake risk in absence of an actual earthquake? It's hard to think about things that haven't happened yet, and people probably just want a roof over their head.
That's very true. I just refinanced my house, and I asked the accredited California real estate appraiser, "Do you want to know if my home was seismically retrofit?" And he said, "No." I said, "What do you mean, no?" He says, "It has no impact on the value of your home, but have you put any marble countertops in any bathrooms?" And I thought, this is absolutely absurd. Ideally, if you strengthen your home, its value should raise, and that should be reflected in the price, which justifies you going through this effort to protect your family and your investment. So we have to change that attitude and let people understand that they can make themselves safer.
But in many countries around the world, retrofitting structures or constructing buildings that aren't vulnerable to earthquakes isn't a big priority. Money is tight, resources are scarce, the population is booming, and people just need a place to live.
Are there particular cities that just give you basically an anxiety attack looking
Yes.
at them?
Yes, there are many cities around the world utterly unprepared. And those tend to be places like Bangladesh, Ecuador. And the problem is that the people who are typically most vulnerable have the fewest financial means to address this concern. I mean, think of the Haiti earthquake in 2010, which killed probably 250,000 people, almost all because of poor construction. There was nothing different about the shaking in that magnitude 7 than the shaking in the magnitude 7 that killed 60 people in the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. Just think of that, 60 versus 250,000. And that's all because of construction quality in a poor country. So if we're really going to change this, we need to work in those countries where the costs in human life are so high and the cost to improve buildings would be so low.
Ross Stein is a geophysicist and the CEO of Temblor. That's a company and app that helps people prepare for earthquakes. Coming up, when what came before continues to haunt you.
It's crazy when you know that's a car, but yet you hear a machine gun and you feel like it's a machine gun, but you know it's not. It's scary. It's scary to think that, like, I'm simultaneously, I feel like I'm in Kosovo in 2004, but I'm really in Ronkonkoma in 2017.
Still to come on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY, offering clinically qualified cancer patients access to the American Society of Clinical Oncology's TAPER study on the effectiveness of new cancer drugs on specific tumor types. More at cancercenter.com. That's cancercenter.com.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Our show today is about what came before, things from the past that are shaping our present. And our next story is about a pre-existing condition within a family. Katie Booth is a writer in Pittsburgh, and she says one of her first and fundamental ways of being came from her grandmother, who taught Booth her native language. And while it didn't quite bridge their difference, it bonded them together. Years later, Booth still struggles and even feels some shame that she let that language slip away.
I learned to sign before I could speak. I wasn't deaf, but my grandparents were, and when I was a baby, I spent my days at their house, where I was immersed in deafness. A child can begin signing months before she speaks, and I picked up the language quickly. They taught me how to sign not only with my hands, but with my face and my body. As a baby, my first sentence was, "Birds fly away, all gone." To make the sentence, begin with your hands close to the body and then flap the wings away. It ends with helplessness on your face, as though nothing could have been done about it. At my grandparents' home, everything was easy to understand with just our eyes. The lamp blinked on and off when the telephone rang. On television, we watched mostly sports and weather. And even after I learned English, we always signed. Back then, I believed that I was on a trajectory toward deafness. As surely as I would have gray hair and wrinkles, I believed that someday I wouldn't be able to hear. At night, I would practice deafness. I'd pull the batting from a stuffed bear and fill my ears against the sounds of the world. I found I didn't mind it. Sign language was fundamental. So much so that the fact that my grandmother could speak was like some dark magic to me. She didn't do it often and never in front of strangers, but I knew she could. I just didn't know how. Then, when I was 6 or 7, she showed me. She lit a birthday candle, held it in front of my lips, and told me to say, "Puh." The flame flickered. "Like that," she said. The candle helped deaf children see their sounds. And that's when I started to hear the story of speaking. My mother told me that for a century, families sent their children to boarding schools, where deaf kids were supposed to learn to speak and lip read. Sign language was not allowed. My grandma grew up in a deaf family, and sign was her first language, too. But away at school, her hands were slapped, black and blue, with rulers, with the paddle back of a hairbrush. Still, she stubbornly brought sign everywhere she went. She taught other students at her school. She taught her first husband, my mother, and me. My grandma shaped my hands and adjusted my face and kept her language alive. Even when I was only 10, it felt like it was my responsibility to carry on our language. But instead, I grew toward the hearing world, away from deafness. I would sign to myself alone at night, trying not to forget. Tented under my covers, I had whole conversations, signed out my favorite songs, and told my oldest stories. But I was still ashamed to sign in the daytime with my grandmother. I didn't want her to see our language slip away. By the time Grandma died, when I was 19, I could barely sign at all. Sometimes I still sign in bed at night, trying not to lose this essential part of myself. But even in my dreams, my fingers stumble and stutter.
Katie Booth is a writer in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. When it comes to pre-existing conditions in the real estate world, Tom Duff has seen it all. Houses black with mold, making families very sick, sewage spills that took his breath away, crime scenes that haunted his dreams, hoarder houses that required huge crews to haul out the trash. He owns a contracting business specializing in tough cleanups. I went with him on a mold inspection, and he told me that in dealing with all of these pre-existing conditions, and especially mold, a lot of the job is about what's not there.
Convincing someone that they don't have a mold problem, even though we are able to do it scientifically, tends to be a difficult task. They get on the internet, and they start searching, and they read all the myths, and they read the scare tactics that are developed by a lot of mold remediation companies. And that's a bad thing. because then you are convinced that you're sick. You're convinced that the house, you need to leave the house. You can't live in it. Your kids are sick. And most of the time when we deal with those clients, sometimes we call them patients, we find that they're not sick as a result of mold. We prove to them scientifically that they don't have a mold issue. And those people I try to help the most because they're clearly suffering. They're spending a lot of money to have mold testing done, so I want to solve their problems. But sometimes telling people that they don't have a mold issue just isn't enough, and they want to go further or they want to keep testing. And it's unfortunate that that happens, but we see that all too often.
So you're part psychologist.
Yeah, for the mold, for the hoarding, and definitely for the crime and death scene cleanup. We're always pacifying somebody or trying to be empathetic and, you know, sympathetic to what's going on, especially in some of the more sensitive cases. And I hire firefighters sometimes that are off duty, or EMTs or police officers, for that kind of cleanup, because they have a better tolerance for the physical end of the cleanup, but they're also trained to have sympathy and empathy for those kind of people.
What do you say to people if you are trying to clean up a house of a hoarder and that person is perhaps elderly, doesn't want their home cleaned up? How do you deal with that?
Well, we can't force them to clean up. If it's not their home and the homeowner has mandated us to clean, then we make it mandatory that the homeowner get that person out of there before we do cleanups, because those situations can escalate into a violent situation, and we've had that happen. But in most cases, if it's somebody that's just open to talking to me, then I tell them, you know, this isn't all that uncommon. And most of the time, they're very embarrassed by their situation. They know that they're hoarders. And it's something that happens over time, and it seems unmanageable to them. And we just tell them, listen, you just need a fresh start. That's what you need. You need a fresh start, because this is making you sick. Anytime you have boxes, floor to ceiling, you're going to have insects, you're going to have rodents. Those things go to the bathroom. When they go to the bathroom, they produce pathogenic bacteria, or the potential of. And so this type of situation not only looks bad, but can make you very sick. So let us give you a fresh start.
Tom Duff owns MasterTech Environmental, a contracting firm in New Jersey that does different kinds of building cleanups. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We've been talking about things from the past that we're dealing with in the present. Our last story is about a guy and his dog. They both have a pre-existing condition, and they saved each other. In 2004, Russell Kaiser served in the U.S. Army in Kosovo during a time of violent unrest. During this conflict, Kosovo Albanians were attacking Kosovo Serbs. Civilians were murdered, hundreds were injured, many were forced out of their homes, which were eventually destroyed. Kaiser was part of a peacekeeping mission that at times was very stressful and dangerous. He developed post-traumatic stress disorder that continued to plague him in his civilian life.
At the worst, I would only sleep maybe 2 or 3 hours a night if I was lucky, and there were interrupted hours, or almost like I'd get like 3 cat naps a night if I was lucky. When I did sleep, the dreams were like I was in a state of pure terror. It was like closing my eyes and going into a horror movie.
Kaiser lives on Long Island, and eventually he found out about a program called Paws of War. They take shelter dogs, some of them slated to be put down, and they train them to be service animals for veterans. A year ago, he was matched with a dog named Artemis.
Stop swearing.
If the service dog helps me stay in public places around people, that means I can get the help I need. Like, you can't get the benefit of, like, a 12-step meeting if you can't be in the meeting due to PTSD reasons. If the dog allows me to stay in the meeting and keeps me from having flashbacks and being hypervigilant or having, like, combat speed reactions, or just keeps the blood pressure and the tension down, or even lowers the tension in the room socially. I got to a point that I would only do my grocery shopping at 7-Eleven because I couldn't handle going into grocery stores, the lights. I wouldn't go to weddings because of the lights and the noise. Same thing with the doctor's office. Same thing at a lawyer's office. Same thing at a grocery store. It would just transfer it into something else in my mind.
Artemis, sit. Just like that.
The dog has a way of just focusing you back into reality, I guess? How it works, I don't know. I don't care. I don't try to figure it out. They said it'll work. I got the dog. I followed the training. It's working. All right. You know, like, I know antibiotics work, too. I don't need to go through the chemical breakdown of it, you know? Like, it just works. The trainer said, like, you're going to figure out, you're just going to spend so much time with the dog that you're going to notice a pattern when she's either, the difference of, like, when she's just being a pain in the butt in the dog, and the difference when she's like, no, Russell, you got to get out of here because you're going to think the Iraqis are coming, or the Albanians, or the Smurfs, whoever's attacking you, you know? For the anxiety level, she starts biting my hand, like a nibble. That's how she does it. And the nightmare, she's waking, licks my face. And also, she tells me when it's time to, when she jumps up and grabs me, that's the cue to remove myself from a place because it's I'm being overwhelmed. She'll know it before I do. And then I learned the hard way by not listening to her and like putting her like, no, you're fine, sit, you know, like meanwhile, then it's like, oh yeah, maybe I should have listened to the dog, got out of there. So she'll actually put herself in between me and other people and block them. And she'll sense before I know it. And it won't be like an attitude thing, like, don't touch me. No, it'd just be more like if someone comes up behind me and like startles me, I might have a reaction. And those reactions sometimes are physical. I might grab you, you know, I might hurl you off of me. It has happened. It seems like it's a lot of preventative. And if I read her signals correctly, then it goes off well. It would be like if there's too many people in the room, she'll start bringing her focus on me to look to keep looking at her and keep petting her. It's amazing. I mean, it's great. I could live a normal life. I could not live a normal life without her.
That's Russell Kaiser and his service dog, Artemis, who came from a shelter. Paige Flager produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Alan Yu. We had help producing this week's show from Alex Stern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager, the associate producer. Tanya English, our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next time on The Pulse, I'm going to lie to a group of med students.
Can you tell me a little bit about what happened real quickly?
All right. I'm a birder, and I went up into this tree.
I'm not a birder.
Okay.
And then I fell, and I hit my side.
Okay.
And then I came down, and my leg is broken.
Okay.
So dramatic. The blood on my leg is fake. The piece of bone sticking out of it is from a deer. It's glued on with wax. This was all part of an extreme course teaching doctors in training how to rescue people in the wilderness. Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Penn Medicine's Transplant Institute supports WHYY. Penn has been performing kidney, liver, heart, lung, and pancreas transplants for more than 50 years. Penn offers advanced options to help decrease wait times and improve outcomes. Learn more about all the options to help patients live and thrive at pennmedicine.org/transplant or 800-789-PENN. Because your life is worth Penn Medicine. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.